Hello, everybody. Welcome to Radio Labyrinth Presents. We have an interview tonight with one of our favorite people. This is his third time on the show. And his name is W. Earl Brown. You know him. He's an actor, musician, screen and songwriter, and a longtime friend of our podcast, going back to episode 89. And that's a long time ago. He has two new movies currently out on video on demand, American Sausage Standoff and No Man of God. I've seen one of those. We're going to talk with him about those films. So spoiler alert right here, right now at the top of the show. And since we've entered into spoopy season, we're going to talk about some of his horror work, like in the movie Scream and maybe some of his all-time favorite horror movies. Please welcome W. Earl Brown. Thank you for coming on again.
Well, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. I think we all had a chance to watch American Sausage Standoff over the weekend. I didn't know what to expect, and I'm pleasantly surprised with the whole thing. It was an enjoyable film.
It's a bit shocking in moments.
Yeah, I'd say so. We gave a spoiler alert in the intro, so we can talk about pretty much anything that happens in the movie, even the the horse scene.
Funny story with that. My agent called me, and Michael said, there's an offer. They had an offer out to someone. The deal's not going to go through. It's moving fast. It's a character who has to ride a horse, play guitar and sing country music, shoot guns. And I said, it is Earl Brown. It is Earl. And luckily, they're Deadwood fans. So there's an offer here. Take a look at this. It's a Danish director. So I start reading it, and I'm about page 75 or 80. I'm close to the end. And my manager calls and she said, Earl, there's a new script. Stop reading because you don't know what changes are going to be made. So wait till you get the new material. Okay. So I stopped reading. Well, they sent it to me that night. And the next morning, I had something going on. I don't remember what, but I was out and about. The agent calls me early afternoon. He said, have you finished that material? I said, no, not yet. He goes, Earl, they're moving fast on this. And they need an answer. Like if they don't have an answer from you late this afternoon, they'll move to the next choice. And I said, well, I laughed out loud in some of the scenes. It's absolutely hilarious. And it's really out there, but yeah, you know what? I'll do it. Yeah, I'll do it. So we signed on, we got a deal. So that night, I guess, sitting around, you know what? I got to finish this, see how this story ends. So I get the new script and I'm reading and I'm 10 pages or so. And I'm like, you know what? There's no change. There's minimal changes, just little dialogue tweaks. So screw it. So I just jumped ahead. Then I got to that. And I was like, wait a minute, what? Scroll back a couple of pages, read up into it. And so, yeah, I met a demise that I had not conceived of before. And I've been killed on camera 30 some odd times. And I thought I died in every way possible until this movie.
Yeah, I was counting the minutes as when is he going to die in this movie? And thankfully, it isn't for quite a while.
Well, Ulrich loved the idea because the character was so loathsome in parts. When he has that tableau at the end of the survivors, he decided to stick me in it like I'm permanently crippled. You know, that they wheel me out in a wheelchair at the very end. So, that might come up, so to speak.
So let's talk a little bit about the movie, just so people understand. It's called American Sausage Standoff, a.k.a. Gutterby, which is the name of the town that the film takes place in. And it has a Western feel. You can kind of get some influence maybe from I got a real Coen Brothers feel.
Oh, yeah.
And the cinematography, by the way, is worth it alone. Even if you just turn the sound off, which I don't recommend. I'm not saying don't listen or pay attention, but I'm saying it is so beautiful, this film. And I don't know who shot it.
Anthony Dodd Banton.
I should have looked that up, but he's amazing. It's beautiful. Everything looks really, really good. And some of the other people in the film, of course, Earl plays Jimmy Jerry Lee Jones Jr., which I want to ask about that name because it's a really cool name. You have Anthony Starr, who plays Mike, who just got out of prison. He's from The Boys and Banshee, among other things. Clark Middleton plays Luke. Interesting character. Really good actor, and I bet you a lot of fun to work with. But you've seen him most recently. I think I've seen him most recently in Twin Peaks, The Return. You have Ewan Bemner, who was Edward, and he was from Trainspotting. He was Spud in Trainspotting. And I'm just pointing out things that, people would know right away. Chance Kelly is the sheriff. He was in Aquarius and Generation Kill. And Joshua Harto, who plays Hank, who plays Earl's son in the movie. He was in Carnival and Jag, and among other things. And also, I think, The Dark Knight, going back to the Batman movie. And written and directed by Ulrich Thompson, who you saw if you watched Banshee. He was the bad Amish guy in that show. Banshee was a cool show. When did you guys shoot this movie?
We shot it a few years ago. When we finished, Ulrich had a post-production team. His editor wasn't available to him, so he set up with the footage for, gosh, like 9 months before he could get his editor involved. And then the first assemblage was really, really long. There's a lot of stuff cut out of the film. And then it was completed in mid-19. So, you know, then COVID happened. He started the film, the festival circuit. It played around Europe. It played here at Santa Barbara Film Festival, which is where I saw it for the first time. And that was right prior to COVID wrecking the world. Yeah. So gosh, we shot it 3 years ago, I guess, that we did the actual shooting.
From the time that you did the performance and the production to seeing it on the screen, did it come out the way you thought it was going to come out? And what were your initial thoughts?
Yeah, there's, I got updates as things went along through production. I knew about the delay of post starting. I never saw the early version. I think Clark actually may have seen it. You mentioned Clark Middleton, you know, that's Clark and I were really close friends. You know, he sadly passed away before the movie came out.
Sorry, I didn't know that. I should have looked it up.
Yeah, Clark passed I think it's 1 year ago today. We're right around the anniversary. Yeah, had West Nile virus. He was my neighbor. When he and his wife moved here from New York, they bought a house not too far from us. They thought it was COVID. One, he tested negative, and then they found out it was West Nile. And you know, he had health issues his whole life, and he didn't survive it. But anyway, Clark, it was such a joy to get to work with him, because I'd known him for several years at that point. And we had met, his brother works for Toby Keith, and they were all big Deadwood nuts in that crew. And back when Deadwood was on, they invited me to a show. We had mutual friend. And for years, they kept saying, "Oh, you got to meet my brother." And Toby said, "You got to meet Clark, Kirby's brother, Clark, man, you guys." And it was, when we met, it was like I'd known him before.
Yeah.
You know, a few times in my life that I've met people, I feel like I know this person. I've known them. And he was one of those. So the joy of getting to work with him, I think my favorite scene was, I'd never seen Clark without a shirt on. We go to do the gym scene where I'm giving him the massage.
Yes.
Try to talk to him. And he pulled his shirt off, and I said, "Oh, hell, man, I know where all that hair on the top of your head went." We took the photo because it was so, the way Anthony had framed it, like you could see Clark's shoulders and you could see his hair on his back. And as I got this Vaseline, and I said, "Somebody take us," because I saw the frame. I said, "Please, before I get the Vaseline on here, take a snapshot of this." So we took a snap on the phone and sent it to his brother, just getting to know each other. We had a lot of laugh out loud scenes in the thing. And then, you know, it's really dark. It's black humor.
Yeah.
It's a satire of America. And you know, and then it's a European's point of view. You mentioned the Coens, because that's what it reminded me most of. But you know, the Coens are heavily influenced by European cinema. And, you know, and their dad was English, so they have that sensibility themselves. So that's how it turned out.
And I like that aspect of the film being kind of a satire on American life without beating it over your head. You don't have, no one's beating over your head. It's just like, okay, you know what this is, and you don't have to read too much into it. You can enjoy it. And the race tracking, or the racist immigrant tracking chicken, was an interesting character. And well, it was a sad end for the chicken or the rooster, but it was just, what the fuck is this thing? But even the close-up shots, it's just beautiful. You see every nook and cranny on the chicken.
Yeah. That was Anthony's work in writing it. Sometimes I ask Ulrich, I went, "Where? How the hell did you even imagine this?" And like the case of my ultimate demise, he read it in a paper, and it actually happened. The guy really did that. He did it of choice. It killed him.
Oh yeah, that's right,
Mr. Hand.
Mr. Hand, yeah.
To copulate with his horse. He loved his horse so much. So I'm like, "You read it?" He goes, "It's in America. Look it up." And I Googled it, and sure enough. So, you know, I don't know where the racist tracking rooster came from, but it was a unique. That bird was difficult to work with, though.
Yeah, I heard that children and chickens are they either steal the show or they're a pain.
Well, he damn near got me killed. My horse, we're shooting that scene where I ride up out of the darkness and I ride up to the restaurant, and they wanted me way, way off camera. It was me and Hank, you know, my son, because my son's riding with the rooster in his basket. So we're way out of the light, and my horses were heading out there. Somebody had disposed of some old plumbing, some old like galvanized pipe was, and my horse stepped on one of those pipes. Oh. So my horse gets really, really, really skittish. So they line us up right next to me. And in the distance, they hit the clapper. And right when they did, the rooster flapped his wings. My horse reared up and bolted wide open, man. And I'm headed toward toward camera and the whole crew. And I've got my hat off and I'm screaming at him, "Out of the way, run away, run away, run away." So luckily they cleared. We made it through, and I did get him pulled up about 30 yards past camera. But the rooster caused that.
The actors who don't know how to ride a horse, are they allowed to be on horses in Westerns or films where there's horses? Because you got to imagine that a lot of them don't know how to do that.
Well, you know, they always ask you if you can ride, and everyone says yes. Uh-huh. Most of them, you know, they took me out to get to know that horse with the Wrangler. And then after, when I pulled him up, he was frothy. And of course, his owner came up, you know, to calm him down, the horse. I just got off of him, handed the reins over.
Yeah.
And that's the one time when I went, "You know what? Me and you are about the same size. Here's my hat. Here's my coat. You ride him on the next day." But yeah, I mean, you've always got a wrangler who's in charge of making sure everybody can ride. And if a movie like, well, hell, with Lone Ranger, some of those guys, they spent like a week in cowboy camp, you know, learning how to saddle and girt and everything, and learning how to ride so you look comfortable in the saddle. Usually I can tell when I'm watching, like, "Oh, he doesn't know how to ride. He's never been on a horse before this." But I grew up in Kentucky, and my mother's family were all horse people, horse meat people and country music, you know, and I wanted rock and roll and motorcycles until I moved away, and then I got, you know, homesick. And so I grew up riding a horse. Not that I'm that great a horseman, but I have ridden a lot.
That's awesome, because if there's ever an apocalypse, you'll be able to get away from whoever's chasing you because you can ride a horse. I haven't been on a horse since 1978, I would say. My stepmother had a horse, an Appaloosa, in Sundance, and there's a picture of me on it, and it was the one second I wasn't screaming. See, when you're 7 years old, those horses, they're huge.
Oh yeah.
And
well, with my grandfather, you didn't show fear. No. Yeah, fear was not allowed. So even though I was absolutely terrified, I kept it inside.
I became
an actor all those years later. Gave me a way to express all that repressed shit.
Has there been any talk of maybe getting the movie onto one of these streaming services, or they're just going to keep it on video on demand?
Yeah, I don't know. Nothing. I heard from Ulrich when we were headed up to release. They told me when that was coming out, the POV, and it played on a POV, a video VOD. On demand, VOD. Yeah. And it played in like a dozen cities in theaters, but I have no idea beyond this initial release. I'm sure at some point it will be on a streaming service,
right?
Not to my knowledge.
You can rent it on Vudu. I rented it on Apple TV Plus. So just to let you know, I paid. I didn't steal it. And I recommend everybody else pay. A movie like this, it's not out in theaters yet, or doesn't have a broad release. It's an independent film with a lot of heart into it. you know, pay for it. It's $6.99. You can rent it or whatever your plans are.
Well, you know, distribution, it's because we're talking earlier about Banshee that I want to watch. There's so much now. There's so much good stuff. It's hard to keep track of, you know, and now everything's a limited series. A lot of the really good writing, the last couple of jobs I've done have been limited series instead of movies. So, you know, I don't know how the distribution dust is going to settle. I haven't been back. No, take it back. I was in Toronto and I went to see Suicide Squad and Shang-Chi in IMAX. So I have been to the movies, in Toronto, but I haven't been back here in Los Angeles. So I look forward to it, but.
Shang-Chi was the first movie I've seen in a theater. Jeff and I saw it 2 weeks ago, first movie or a week ago or whatever, but first film I've seen in a theater since that Adam Sandler jewelry movie.
Uncut Gems.
Yeah.
Uncut Gems. That's a great movie. Yeah.
Yeah. He was robbed of any awards, I think, or at least a nomination. But I was going to say that speaking of so many good shows, the show that's blowing me away right now is Reservation Dogs.
Yeah. Just watched it last night. Just caught up on it. Watched the end of this season. The last three episodes. Yeah, it's a great show.
So emotional and so funny, yep. Well written. There's nothing wrong with that show at all. Bill Burr did a really good job in that episode where he played the coach. Looking for.
I said it. My wife and I were talking about it last night. You know, not just reservation life. That's kind of what life was like where we grew up and how we grew up. You know, and the culture not a whole lot different. You know, that's small town, middle of nowhere America.
I was just saying, there's always. Not necessarily another gang, but older, tough kids want to beat you up, and you're always running away from them.
Yeah, and that dream. I'm interested to see where they take the story next season. You know that because I really didn't expect any of them to get out of town, but those two left. So I'm interested to see where it goes. I don't know. I don't think they're back in production yet. I know they've got another season ordered, maybe even two. Yeah, I love that show.
Yeah,
everything Taiki Waititi touches turns to gold. And
that What We Do in the Shadows are my wife and I's two shows.
Yeah,
like, you know,
you got to get on Wellington Paranormal too. That's
that's the first kind of spinoff of the movie, right? Yeah,
yeah.
What's it streaming on?
It's just
HBO Max.
It just finished its run on the CW, so now one and two are on HBO Max.
Oh,
are you allowed to have HBO Max in your Disney household?
I have them all, man. Yeah. Are you kidding? I have to have them all. But we pay for our Disney, by God. It's not even free.
Yeah, you can watch Banshee on HBO Max also.
Yeah, I know it's on there because I've checked. Yeah, my wife actually, she's swamped with work right now. Did I tell you the story about her and Mandalorian?
No.
You know, to work on the Mando, the NDA was like 12-14 pages. You know, you cannot talk about, you know, work until the show's out there. So the way I came up on Mando, my agent calls me and Michael says, Earl, what's your feeling on prosthetics? I know you said you hate them. I said, no way, not doing it. Unless somebody's paying me seven figures and ain't nobody gonna pay me seven figures, nothing. I ain't doing it. Cause I had done an episode of Angel where I had full prosthetics and it was sheer misery. Hmm. Well, Michael says, well, there's an offer come in. It's a TV thing. It's through Disney. It's some Star Wars thing, but I'll let them know. I said, wait a minute. Some Star Wars thing. He said, yeah. I said, you talking about John Favreau's? Are you talking about Mandalorian? Yeah. Do you know about it? I said, oh, no, I've heard. I know it's John's thing. Yeah. Yes, I'll do it. Yes, I'll do it. So I was just sent the scenes. It hadn't aired yet. So they're starting the second season. So I was sent the scenes that I was in, and that was it, you know. And I had to go in for makeup confabs, and I talked to John. They kind of fill me in on story things about my character. But my scenes say the child, right? So he told me about Oliphant, you know, they hired Oliphant. And he did not consciously recreate Deadwood in space, but he unconsciously did. And I knew Pedro. So we're there, and Tim walks up, and I give him a line from Deadwood. I said, you ought to pin that badge on your chest. You're just hypocrite enough to wear it. Tim throws some Deadwood line back at me and everybody laughs, right? And Favs comes up and he goes, I didn't mean to. It's Deadwood. It's just... Well, the props guy comes in with the cart and there's a little baby Yoda on the cart. And I thought, oh, that's sweet. The props guy went and made himself a little baby Yoda just for fun. That's awesome. He goes, all right, well, let's rehearse. Well, I'm still thinking, where's the child? Where the hell's the child? Where's the kid? So they enter. Well, there's a puppeteer with baby. And that's when I realized, oh, my God. So that night I'm home for dinner and all I'm like fanboying. Okay. So there's a Bantha. Like I got, there's a real Bantha. So I'm on Tatooine. Like, did you know there's a baby Yoda? There's like in the show, there's a baby Yoda. And my wife gets this big smile on her face. And I went, you knew about it. You knew. And she said, you're not the only one with an NDA. So 2 days later, or the next day or 2 days later, Mando premiered. And then suddenly baby Yoda's everywhere. But I had no clue until that very moment.
You mentioned last time that they were scanning you for an action figure. Is there been any news on that front?
I did get scanned. I have not heard anything official as of yet. And I can't talk about anything. Even if I did know, I couldn't say it. So I keep everything very quiet about my involvement with that. But, you know, like, hell, that's why I wanted to be in movies. There is a Millennium Falcon hanging above me right now here in my room.
Is there going to be a Jimmy Jerry Lee Jones Jr. and horse action set? Maybe Lego.
Yeah, it's fully posable.
And I know you like to collect action figures of other actors that you work with. And I don't know if you want to jump into the, maybe I'm the only one that's seen it here, but the No Man of God movie.
Yeah, No Man of God came out. We were shooting a year ago today because I found out Clark had died while I was on the set. Clark Middleton that we spoke of earlier. That was one that came about. I met with Amber Seeley, who directed it. I met with them right before COVID happened. And you know, then the world shut down. So I didn't know what was, they had said, oh, we want you to be in the film. But my agent called like 2 weeks before. So that was the first thing in COVID. You know, we had very, very strict COVID protocol. And I think Amber, she had, I don't think she ever got sick, but the days I was on set, she was having to direct from her car. I think she'd had a positive test.
Oh, no.
So she's on an iPad and we're on earpieces, you know? So when they had the virtual premiere, I was in Toronto working and I was working that day and I couldn't make it. I haven't seen the film yet. I mean, I know I've read all the reviews and the reviews have been exceptionally positive. And I saw some of that stuff being filmed. One of the scenes between the two characters I was watching and I knew like, oh, whoa, this it was pretty extraordinary.
It's Elijah Wood playing FBI agent. Maybe you know who he is, Tim.
Bill Hagmeier.
Bill Hagmeier, yeah.
Yeah, they wrote the books and did. They based a couple of shows off of his work, maybe.
Yeah, I think I thought maybe Mindhunters or one of those kind of shows was based on his stuff. Yeah, so Elijah Wood plays him, and Luke Kirby, the guy, he's in Marvelous Mrs. Maisel.
Lenny Bruce,
yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he looks like Bundy.
Yeah.
It was pretty eerie.
Yeah, that guy was so, you know, I guess 1970s handsome. I mean, he was tall. Yeah. Drove a bug, but I mean, that's the story that just keeps, they just keep retelling these stories, and Manson's another one. I mean, that's a well you keep dipping into. You know, I think though, for me, the period on that sentence of the Manson era is Tarantino's movie. I thought that was fun and a good way to just, it didn't happen because these guys shot and killed him.
Did you watch the, or read the book, Quentin's book?
No, I haven't.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah, I've read the book.
I heard him talk about it on I think Rogan or Maron, one of those two, and I want to get that book.
Yeah, it gives someone.
I went on a hunt in Toronto because Toronto was still on lockdown, and I knew the book was publishing and most everything was closed. And I was trying to find a bookstore that would be open that I could find it on the day it published. And luckily, I want to say it was the day you were allowed to go in the mall, but it's still masked and everything. And I found the big Canadian chain. They had it. So I bought it immediately, went right to Queensway Park and sat there and read all afternoon. And then I woke up the next morning and the next day I had off and I read it all. And now then I rewatched the movie. I've watched that movie a lot. So yes, I'm a big fan of the book. And if you like the movie, it's a new perspective. And there's a new ending in the book, as you may or may not know. Doesn't end the same way the movie does.
Like one of those old novelizations that people used to do. Mm-hmm. For films. Cool.
I'm hoping that he does, because I know he had talked about it in the press, so I'm not talking out of turn. He wanted to shoot Bounty Law as a limited series. Like he had written like five or six of them. And then he had what he'd said in this interview, he had eight in mind because he wrote the first one just to kind of as he was doing Once Upon a Time. But he wants to shoot it exactly like, you know, the same format, same film, shoot it like an old 60s Western. And he shot that. That's on the Deadwood set. So, you know, I've met with Quentin twice on two different projects and have yet to get hired. But I'm so hoping that you know, movie gets, or that TV series gets made.
Tim will put in a good word for you, won't he?
Cocksucker better. Whoops, can I say that? Yeah.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. And No Man of God, that's available video on demand also. It's not streaming on any services yet, but you can get it if you want to watch it.
They came out the same day. Sausage Story and No Man of God.
And both were great, although Earl was featured more in American Sausage Standoff than he was in No Man of God, but both are really good movies.
Thank you. Yeah, I have a lead in Sausage.
Yeah.
In Ass, I've got a lead.
I like that episode of Bates Motel. You're like, oh, yeah, cool. He's going to be, oh.
Yeah. Well, I just worked with Carlton and Vera. I just spent 4 months with them in Toronto. And we relived our time on Bates. That show taught me a very valuable lesson. And my wife teased me about it. I'm here in my house back when I still got my print issues, you know, of Variety and Hollywood Reporter, and it was announced. And I said, sitting here in my living room, I said, they're doing a prequel to Psycho set in the current. That's the dumbest idea I've ever heard for a show. Months later, I'm in Canada doing, what was it called? Amazon show with Tandy Newton. Anyway, my agent calls, says, we have an offer for you. It's this Bates Motel. I said, oh, let me. And then I read it. Oh, my God. The script was phenomenal. So my agent calls and he said that. I said, I'll do this. So he said that they want a photo of you, what you look like right now. We were literally on adjoining sound stages with my show with Tandy was on the next sound stage where they were prepping for Bates. So I said, hell, I'll just walk over there. So I walked right into the production office and it was so funny to look on Carlton Cuse's face. So he's like, do you live here? I just hung up. I just spoke to your agent. Yeah. So it ended up being, you know, I thought it sounded like a dumb idea for a show and it was an extraordinary show. And, you know, I only had two scenes. But the whole first six episodes of that show were called the Keith Summers arc. You know, he was the instigating factor of everything that happened through the first six episodes. The scene itself, those kind of scenes are really, really difficult to shoot. You know, whether you're with a horse or, I was just so incredibly proud and pleased of how that turned out. And it was funny with my daughter, who was completely unimpressed by me or anything I'd ever done. She was in high school when that came on. And she came home from school that afternoon. She goes, well, I guess I have to give you some credit. I said, for what? And she goes, well, you've certainly raised my profile in the high school halls because everywhere I've walked all day, I've heard people whisper, that's the rapist's daughter.
How did she handle it when you were in Scream? she would have been a little younger. Well, see,
she wasn't around yet.
Right.
And so Scream was, you know, it was an old movie to them. But her generation, they were all Scream nuts.
Yeah.
You know, one of her close friends, he was a Scream fanatic. He loved the genre, but Scream was his favorite movie of all time. And I gave him my robe, you know, as an opening gift. They give you some little something. I still have my Scream sweater. It was called A Scary Movie, Scream. I still have the closing gift, but the opening gift was a bathrobe that said Scary Movie. So I gave it to, you know, one of her friends. And it's funny with that. I also gave away when that movie finished, I was offered my wardrobe. And you know, in early movies, not that I'd done that many before, but, you know, I saved everything. So I had boxes of crap. You know, movies came and went. And so they offered me the stuff with Scream. And I'm like, you know, I get it. I get the little homage. Got to float that Cheeto around. So I was offered and I said, you know what? I'll wear the Chuck Taylors, and I'll probably wear those Hawaiian shirts. Do you want the Top Story jacket? I'm like, I'll never wear that. So I came home. My neighbor kid down the way lived across the street from us, Andy. Andy Garofalo, his mom worked at NBC, and she used to hook us up with Jay Leno tickets, anything we needed from NBC for, you know, family coming to visit. Andy was all about Scream. Loved it. I gave him my murder shirt, the shirt that I was wearing when I got killed, you know, on the top of the van. Well, Andy is now married. He has a kid on his own. He's a lawyer. And his mom, this has been, gosh, this was in the springtime. She called me and she goes, I have a box of Andy's old toys. Do you want them? Like, he's got all these cool action gear. I got an 18-inch McFarlane Michael Myers. I said, I'll take them. Sure.
Nice.
And she goes, oh, and there's this old shirt you gave him. Do you want this? And I knew what I said. Are you sure Andy doesn't want that? I mean, like, as a collectible, that's probably worth something. And she goes, let me text him. So he's no, it's fine. So I got back my murder shirt. You know, I have it here. I'm going to put it in a shadow box at some point, put it somewhere.
Did you get to keep anything from To Hell and Back? Today is Meatloaf's birthday, the day that we're recording. So
I know I have two of the Ruffle shirts, the Ruffly shirts. I kept the tuxedo, but I think I gave it away to somebody. I did a photo shoot in a swimming pool wearing that tuxedo. So I'm like, I have an old Meatloaf tour shirt that was given to me. I think was from the movie. But yes, today is ML's 74th birthday.
Are you friends with him?
His daughters quite a bit. His daughter Pearl, we both have bands here. And before COVID struck, we played several shows together. And we've been talking about going back out to, we did Pappy and Harriet's, my band and her band. So I hear from Pearl quite often. She's married to Scott Ian of Anthrax.
Oh, wow.
And we're friends with those guys. He's the guitarist in Anthrax, the bald headed guy.
Oh, I thought he was the drummer. Why do I think he was the drummer?
No, drummer's Charlie Benanti. Scott is Charlie and Scott started that band when they were in high school.
Scott was also wearing Soldiers of Death, Stormtroopers
Soldiers of Death. Stormtroopers of Death.
Yeah, was he also in MOD? No, I don't think he was in MOD. That was just Billy Milano and some other dudes.
Yeah, Stormtroopers of Death started as, you know, kind of tongue in cheek.
Right.
And when I met them, they had, because they had done a Stormtroopers tour. And for Short Bus, they expanded the song in concert, and they had sampled Something About Mary.
Mm-hmm.
So they were using my voice in their set, you know, in that song, before I ever got to know those guys. But yeah, Scott and Pearl they met right about the time that we were doing the Meatloaf movie. And then Amanda, her sister, her younger sister, she now lives in Kentucky. So I hear from them often. But ML, he was weird about the movie. I mean, hell, I guess if a movie was made about my life, I'd probably be a little weirded out by it too. Yeah. So I don't really hear from him anymore. You know, if I see him, he's friendly. I'm a friend of his daughter's, but I don't really hear from him. No, I know he lives in Nashville now.
That's one of those albums that I still have. The original Bat Out of Hell album is a rotation of mine that I'll listen to it every couple of months, maybe, because it's just emblematic of 1 year of my life. Mm-hmm. Listen to it on 8-track. I know which song faded away and then came back when the eight, mm-hmm. Chunk, and then I had to go to the next track. As a little kid, but still, we listened to that the whole way and back to New Jersey one summer, and it was just stuck in my head. And it's a great album, Jim Steinman.
I remember going to Daytona Beach, Florida that summer. We would go for a few summers. And when my mom, you know, I could get a souvenir and whatnot, I wanted to go to the mall and buy records because I couldn't really get all the records I wanted in my small hometown. And I bought that summer, I bought Elvis Costello's This Year's Model. I bought Van Halen's first record. There's another one I'm missing, and Bat Out of Hell on vinyl. And I had given away, when I switched over to CDs, I gave away a lot of my vinyl, you know, regret it now. But when that movie happened, the kid I had given my Meatloaf vinyl to sent it back to me. So I still have my original vinyl that I bought in Daytona Beach, Florida in 1978. Nice. And it's still a great record. It's so weird. You know, it's so over the top, but they got just the right amount of sense of humor. The tongue is in cheek just enough that it sells all those songs so well. And I think Paradise by the Dashboard Light is just ingenious as a song. And Two Out of Three holds up. I got to do Two Out of Three Ain't Bad with the Drive-By Truckers once.
Oh, nice.
Pat and Mike said, one of these days you got to sing with us. Let's do a Meatloaf song. So we arranged it and did it. That was fun.
Dustin's brother's in a very popular touring band. Why don't you talk about that?
Oh, my brother. He's the guitarist for St. Paul and the Broken Bones. He used to be Jason.
Oh yeah,
guitarist for the first three albums. He did the album covers, the artwork. Browen. Yeah.
Uh huh.
Yeah.
I probably met him. When Jason first started 400 Unit. I just missed them in Vancouver. Like, they had just started that band. Mm-hmm. And this was before he had recorded anything. Is your brother on Southeastern? Was he playing with him?
Yeah,
at that
point? He was on it with him. Yeah, he was the first 400 Unit guitarist, and he actually traveled around with Jason before they started the 400 Unit all over Europe. So anytime you see those YouTube videos of Jason in a cafe somewhere, he's the other guitarist. Yeah.
Oh yeah. I probably met him because I met Jason back in the Drive-By Trucker days. When Deadwood was on the air and he had just joined, that was on, I guess it was Dirty South. It may have been Decoration Day, but he was still relatively new to the band and they were all big into Deadwood. And then Ray McKinnon, they had done the music for Ray's short film, The Accountant.
Right.
And then Tracy Thomas, who's still their manager, still works with Jason. She used to work for Steve Earle. So it was all kind of interconnected. I knew her through Steve. So yeah, I got to know those guys back then, and have maintained a friendship with them ever since.
Yeah, they're still all just a big family. When he exited the Truckers, he pretty much picked up my brother from Fame because my brother was, you know, tracking guitars at Fame at the time, and he just picked him up and took him on the road with him.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that I met him. I met a couple of guys at Fame. When I did there's still a show. It's called Music Row to Muscle Shoals. Mm-hmm. And they'll bring players down from Nashville to do a set. And I did it back with Jeff Robertson, who's a much better musician than me. But we did it when they were still at the old Holiday Inn. And they said, hey, do you want to go to Muscle Shoals Sound and to Fame? And I'm hell yeah. So I got the backstage tour of the Fame Studios. And your brother, if he was playing there, man, he can play.
Yeah, that's a town full of musical history.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Fascinating. Are you from that area?
We're from Knoxville originally, but he had moved there during elementary school and grew up around all those people. You know, don't expect to see the backup band from Aretha Franklin playing on a Wednesday night, you know, getting your beer.
Well, you know, that's Patterson's dad. He's a Swampward. Yep. David was the bass player in the Swampers. His birthday just a couple of days ago. Mm-hmm. Speaking of that, Johnny Depp has the rights to Rick Hall's book.
I'd heard that.
And at one point that was kind of in active development. And then, you know, the troubles happened. So I don't know. I'm still hoping at some point, you know, he will make that as a movie or a limited series or something. Because I will clamor. I'll go knock on his door. put me in this. I really, really want to be in this.
While we're talking about music, your band just put a new music video out, right? And it's got some Deadwood ties to it. Maybe tell people where they can find it. And
that all kind of came about from 20 years ago. Dunsmore just got re-released. But the director, Perspirer, I'm sitting playing guitar. Peter comes back and goes, "Oh, I didn't know you play." I went, "You play?" I went, I used to. I hand him my guitar. He's 3 times the guitar player I'll ever be. And then I realized I knew his band. I didn't even know he played, but the band Z-Toys, which was MTV's Basement Tapes, 1986 or 85, I saw it and I knew it. Peter gained quite a bit of weight and he cut his hair. So he didn't look anything like, you know, the 80s rock star. So he had never listened to country music. So our wives became friends and we went to see Down from the Mountain, the bluegrass tour. He got obsessed with bluegrass. So that's kind of where it grew about us trading songs, you know, and me playing, you know, certain bluegrass cut stuff he hadn't heard before. So the band, we'd started at my 40th birthday party and went good. And we were like a dad band, except we were better than the dad band in the short film. But when Deadwood, the season 2 rap party happened, we had the House of Blues. And the producer of the show said, "Hey, if you guys want to play, we don't really have a budget." But so I invited the pedal steel player in Cowboys, was in the background of Deadwood. And then I brought Ralph Stevens in. So we became a 7-piece band. That's how it started. It went so well that we became a band. We were on Stagecoach in 09. And the joke I love to tell, because it's a joke, but the band that played right before us, nobody had heard of. I don't know whatever happened to this Zac Brown band. But in 2009, my career went in another direction. I could not commit to it. And we had to put it out to pasture for a while. It lasted much longer than we thought. We started playing together again right around the time the Deadwood movie happened. And we had a monthly gig here. We recorded. So that's a very long answer to say we're on YouTube. It's called Sacred Cowboys. The latest video is John Ed Ballantyne. It is an Old West murder ballad that was the backstory to Dan Doherty. We don't tie the song together with the TV show. There's no mention of his name or any of that. But it tells the story of how he became the murderous Dan Doherty attached to Al Swearingen. And that all started with because David Milch always encouraged us to come up, you know, write about our characters. So that's how it started. And then I was in Alaska doing a movie. And so I just started my downtime. I was playing and I wrote it, first of all, as a narrative epic poem. And then I thought, you know what, this could be a song. So I wrote it way back when, the initial version. We recorded it 3 times over the years. We finally got a version I liked. And I had this idea for the video of being like the old Louis L'Amour books or Zane Grey. You know, they always had these illustrations at the first of each chapter, a line drawing that would kind of show you some image. Yeah. So that's what I had in mind. And Blake Armstrong is a good friend. He's a big, the Venom campaign's out right now. That's all his artwork. So he's from my neck of the woods. So I'd called him up and I said, you know, can you refer anybody? He goes, let me hear your song. And I said, I just, you know, want some line drawings. If there's some artist that works, you know, some apprentice. And he listened to the song and he goes, I got an idea. Because Red Dead Redemption 2 was just hitting.
Yeah.
About 3 days later, he sent me all these pieces of art that just blew me away. Like, it's so much better than what I envisioned it in my head. You know, I just envisioned us sitting around a campfire, me telling a story, and there'd be a few line drawings. But he illustrated the song, and it plays like a graphic novel. And we posted, it's been up less than a week now. It's on YouTube. It's called John Ed Ballantyne, the name of the antagonist. And it's Sacred Cowboys is the band. When we named ourselves all those years ago, we didn't know there had been a punk band, a new wave band in Australia back in the early mid 80s. So if you Google Sacred Cowboys and you find a bunch of really skinny guys in black turtlenecks with eyeliner, that ain't us. So, but yeah, Sacred Cowboys. Thank you for the plug.
It's a great video too.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm beyond pleased. We did the first video we released we actually had a promoter that got it placed. It's called It's a Beautiful Day. That song, we got a lot of radio play from it. The John Ed Ballantyne song, it's 5 minutes long and it's really dark. So, I don't think we're going to get the same radio reception that we got the first one, but
you get played.
I'm very proud of the end result. Yeah.
You get played on AAA stations or country stations. What kind of stations? I'm curious. Cause I work in radio and I know it's very difficult to get anything. Americana station.
Americana's who picked us up. Well, Outlaw Country, of course, they're kind of the opinion leader. You know, they're one of them in the Americana format because the Americana, you know, it's a smaller format.
Oh, yeah.
And we had Bob Mitchell, who had retired from Sony Nashville, saw us years ago. He was from Bakersfield, and he's been a fan all along. And he was prodding us to get this record done. He wanted us to get it done when we did the Deadwood movie. But that was too soon. We were just starting to play together again. So Bob helped us out. He opened a lot of doors for us in radio, but his background was more, you know, mainstream country. And that's not us. It's a really odd, eclectic group of players. I'd love to play. I'm not a natural musician. Some of the guys I play with in the band are extraordinary musicians. So I'm very proud of it.
Well, it just makes me happy being in the industry and knowing how difficult it is that there are still good stations out there that'll add new music and different music. Cause like pop is what it is. And country now is mostly pop country, unless you find a station that plays older stuff. You know, everything changes, but it's nice to have that additional stuff.
It's so funny with that, talking about genre. And I just say this really as a fan, because American Aquarium just released this covers of 90s country. And there's kind of this classic, it's 90s country is making a comeback, right? Well, I was around when that happened. You know, country purists in the 90s did not like most 90s country, you know? And I think that that's always been the case. I remember, you know, Uncle Dave Macon, I found these old radio interviews. You know, he was the star of the Grand Ole Opry. And when Earl Scruggs came around playing banjo, because Earl invented, you know, that clawhammer banjo, Dave Macon hated it. You know, and there were interviews where he said, that boy doesn't know how the banjo is played. So, you know, every generation has its, this is what my genre is. This is what country music is.
Yep.
It all changes, you know.
Some of those 90s acts and some of those acts that are stuck there, but they had a lot of really good songs. Sammy Kershaw had some good hits.
Oh, yeah.
David Ball, who you probably couldn't pick out of a crowd now, but Thinking Problem. Yeah, great song. I worked overnight at a convenience store, and the only station I could get was a new country station. This is about 95. And I worked at a Unimart overnight, and I just listened to all that country. So, I mean, I liked Garth Brooks because my first real radio job was at a country station in 1991. So that's, you know, so it was Garth and it was Brooks and Dunn when they came out, and I would get in trouble for playing Johnny Cash. The program director called me, goes, no, you could play Johnny Cash, stuff like that overnight. Well, you can't play it during the day. I go, well, you just can't play it. You just got to wait. You got to wait until nighttime. Like, all right, I'll play that.
He doesn't even have a label now. He got dropped.
Yeah,
Johnny Cash is old news.
And if you got to take a shit, play a 30-minute Alabama song from that live album. Okay. I just made that up, but I did do that.
Well, you know, Rick Rubin rescued Johnny, and he's what made him into the mythological being that he deservedly became.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder if Rick Rubin hadn't bequeathed Johnny as cool in making those American recording albums. I don't know if we would speak of Johnny in the same tone that he is, you know, because again, it's mythological.
You can hear every wrinkle on his face in those songs. They're beautiful.
Yeah. My buddy Ferg, who's just got a great record out, Fergie Ferguson, David Ferguson. He's on Fat Possum. It's Chardonnay's the name of his album. He was Johnny's engineer for years, and he did those records. And I was there. I got to visit. Rick flew him out here to do the after John passed, and there were 70 some odd songs left. And they basically had to make the records in reverse. They took the vocal track, and then they had to fill in all the instrumentation and try to fix the time and whatnot because John was really ill. And as Ferg said, if John could get out of bed after June died, if he could get out of bed, all he could do was sing. Yeah. And he would call Ferg and go, meet me at the cabin. And so they would go to John's cabin at the end of his property and set up, and Fergie would record him doing those songs. So I got to witness, I saw Benmont Tench. I spent 2 days over there when Benmont was there laying down keyboards and piano on some of those tunes. And I just, those, that whole set of recordings are just some of the greatest stuff ever done. When you say you could hear every wrinkle on his face, that's a perfect, perfect metaphor.
And still, I listen to him over and over again, but I still get I'm getting goosebumps now, even thinking about going out and listening to him when we're finished. Yeah, I mean, just they're just amazing encapsulation of one of the greatest musicians. And you know, he was also funny and a good actor, and he did all the TV shows. And I don't know, that you had to be, he had to be a little bit of everything back in that time frame. You know, you're on TV, you're touring and stuff like that.
Before we wrap, maybe since it's going to be spooky season, and Earl could rattle off a couple of his favorite all-time horror movies. Just,
oh man,
keep the playing through the month of October on YouTube.
Well, it's my, I've always said the big three that made me want to be in movies: Star Wars, Animal House, Halloween, the original Halloween. So that's got to be number one. And then Nightmare on Elm Street, the original, Wes's original.
Oh yeah.
Because it's so wickedly smart. I was taught, as I got to know him, because at first when I got cast by him, I didn't know he didn't do the sequels except for the, you know, three. I hated two.
Yeah.
The, you know, the Freddy Krueger thing. And I said, you know, it kind of reminds me thematically of Ghosts. Are you talking about Ibsen's Ghost? I said, yeah, man, with that whole sins of the parents passed on to the kids theme. He goes, oh, Ghost was a huge influence when I was writing it. So he walks me through, you know, the philosophy behind these choices he made, and, you know, then his torturous childhood. And it's just wickedly smart, and there's so many layers to it. So that, Silence of the Lambs, of course. You know, I think it's the only true horror movie that was ever taken seriously by critics.
Yeah, and every Oscar that year.
Mm-hmm. And I love recent stuff. I loved what David Gordon Green did with the rebirth of Michael Myers. You know, Halloween in 18, I thought it was wonderful.
Yeah.
One, I don't know if it qualifies as horror, and it's a movie that I can't find anymore. But I remember watching it in the 80s, and it scared the living shit out of me and creeped me out, was Man Bites Dog.
Oh, yeah, the French movie.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's so insidious and creepy. But I always set up my big 12-foot screen on my patio, put my projector up, and I watch horror movies every weekend, month of October.
Nice.
So I guarantee you there will be Halloween, and David Gordon Green's Halloween will be a double feature one night. I just found in my Blu-ray of Dear Dead Delilah, which was kind of one of the lost genre classics that Cowboy Jack Clement produced. And it disappeared for many, many years. It's a terrible drive-in horror film from the 70s.
Yeah, but that means it's good.
Yeah, it's going to be one of those on my patio movies here.
Awesome. Well, what a great treat to talk to you again. Thank you very much.
All right.
All right.
See you all next time.
Yes, Earl. Thanks so much.